ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If this thing is built, it will be a miracle to behold.
One of science's biggest promises.
It would be like the Wright brothers moment.
Governments, spies, billion-dollar investments, and scientific rivalries.
The control that's required is rivaled only by what God did in creating the universe.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
What is it like to have the responsibility to decide if a serious violent offender should be released from prison and allowed back into the community? How do you balance the need to protect the community with the goal of rehabilitating an offender? Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. I'm speaking with Rob McKeon. He's been a member of the Parole Board in England and Wales since 2012. And over that time, he's helped decide the fate of thousands of prisoners. Rob's the author of a book titled Parole, which explores the dilemmas he encounters in his role. And a warning, today's conversation does contain discussion of violent crime. Rob, welcome to the Law Report.
Thank you, and thank you for having me along.
In England, what sorts of offenders come before the Parole Board?
Well, we've got about 85,000 people in prison in England and Wales, and 90% of those will get released automatically. They're what's called fixed-term sentences. So they will have a sentence set by the courts. They'll know that partway through that sentence, they'll be released, and they will serve the rest of that sentence in the community. And I'm looking at the top 10%, the most serious offences, those ones who've been given perhaps very long sentences because of the serious nature of what they've done, or they've been given indeterminate sentences, like a life sentence. So people who've committed murder, serious sexual offences, terrorism, very serious levels of violence, they're the kind of cases that I consider day in and day out.
You're dealing with the most serious type of offender. How does the parole system work? What decisions can the board make about a prisoner? There are pretty much three options, aren't there?
So first and foremost, I have to consider whether somebody can be released on license. And if that can be a life license, if you're subject to a life sentence, you'll be subject to that license for the rest of your life. And I can set your license conditions and tell you how you must behave and what you can and what you can't do. In certain cases, I can decide whether people, if they're not to be released because they're not yet safe to be released, should go to an open category prison. So that's a prison where there aren't walls and big tall gates where people can come and go a bit, still under restriction, but they have some more freedom. So I can consider that aspect of it, or I can decide that actually their risk is too great and they need to stay inside a closed prison where they need to continue to look at addressing the things that brought them into prison in the first place.
So stay in prison, move to an open prison, or move out into the community on license or what we call parole conditions. What are the parole conditions that you can put on a prisoner?
Well, I'm looking at all the things, all of those external controls that will help to keep people safe. So I can impose things like curfews, keeping people in at night. In certain cases, I can impose polygraph testing, GPS tagging, where we can keep a track of where people are, where they go and where they don't go. Alcohol monitoring, including alcohol abstinence tagging, which means that they can't drink. It measures the sweat in your leg from the tag and determines whether you've been drinking or not. Exclusion zones, non-contact conditions, various other restrictions, deciding what you can do, where you can go, and how you can do it, including stop and search and other tracking of mobile phones, internet use, computer use, and use of vehicles. So it really is extensive. You're looking at all of those aspects of somebody's life that led them to behave in a certain way, that led them to cause harm to somebody else, and those measures in place that means that I need to make sure that they're being monitored. So if your offending comes from drugs and alcohol, drug testing, alcohol monitoring, they can be part of your license.
There's the idea that if you can test somebody, whether an offender is now on a better path, while you can still have leverage over them before their sentence is complete, assuming they're not on a life sentence, you have these levers, you have that leverage that you wouldn't otherwise have. And that's something which should be used before they're let go completely free.
I think there's a fair point in that. I mean, first and foremost, my job is to protect the public. So whether there's a benefit to somebody coming out of prison and having some supervision and support from probation is secondary to that. But reality is people come from chaos a lot of the time who commit offences. They've had terrible early life experiences. Now, not everybody, let's not, you know, we're not having a soft attitude towards crime. Some people do things and they do awful things. But a lot of the time, the background and those early life experiences lead them on a path that takes them into to certain ways. I remember a woman I met who was serving a life sentence, and all of her offending was driven through drug addiction. And her offending started because when she was a child, her mum used to give her tranquilizers to keep her quiet. And that was this person's route then into addiction. So sometimes you look at people's lives and you think, there, for the grace of God, go for a lot of it. If you have that chaos and that difficulty in life, and you come to a certain level of stability within prison, what we've seen and what data shows and research shows is that every time there's a transition in your life, your risk will change. So the minute you walk out of a prison gate, your risk is going to change. The minute you move to different accommodation. So if the probation service can be monitoring that and giving you that support and referring you into the drug agencies and alcohol support or housing or employment opportunities or whatever else might be out there, isn't that a great thing to actually be doing in terms of if we're looking to genuinely give people a chance at rehabilitation? And I think that's what having people on license probably does.
You talk in your book about a lot of people who have had very difficult lives who go on to do terrible things. I mean, one of the people you talk about is a woman called Victoria who, you know, drug taker since the age of 14, addicted to heroin and crack. She gets drunk one day and outside a pub and pushes a man onto the road. He's hit by a car and dies. 4 years for manslaughter. After her release, uses a knife to mug a young woman and then goes back to jail. Heavy, heavy drug user. And every time she comes out of prison, she fails her drug tests and gets pulled back in. She needs rehab, right? She needs specialist rehab. But of course, those resources are not necessarily there. You have this dilemma. What do you do with when the resources aren't necessarily there to actually place them properly?
I mean, getting a rehab placement is like gold dust sometimes. But those opportunities do work for people. But what I've seen and what you see from Victoria's case, because she is somebody whose actions led to somebody's death, and even that experience of being responsible for a man's death doesn't lead her to change. As soon as she's out of prison, she's back using drugs, back using alcohol, back causing problems, back inside prison. And so you've got to actually get to that point of wanting to be different. You can give anybody a number of offending behavior programs and courses and support and whatever else, but you've got to want to be different, haven't you? And I think that addiction is often at the heart of a lot of people's problems, and it's a really, really hard thing to fight off. But you do see people make changes, and you do see people get the support and eventually find a life of abstinence. And I think in Victoria's case, it was a very long journey. I wondered whether anything would ever change in her life. And it took years and years and years, but eventually she found a path, and it did. And I think for other people, there is that opportunity to do something different.
You also spoke about another person, Danny, who is jailed for seriously assaulting his 16-year-old girlfriend with a knife, slashing her in the arm, hitting her with a hammer. Again, somebody with extraordinary challenges, extraordinary deprivation in his life. But your job is, you know, the priority for you, no matter where people come from, is to protect the community, to protect the next girlfriend who might be a potential victim. How do you balance the needs of somebody who's had a terrible life with the need to protect people from violent crime?
And I think you've made an important point there of that my job is to protect the public. And I can have empathy for people's situations. There's a big thing actually when I was writing the book where I'd mentioned a lot about having empathy for people's situations, and the publishers came back and said, well, can't you say sympathy? And I said, well, I can't say sympathy because sympathy is an emotion, whereas empathy is just stating a fact of I can empathize with the situation that you're in. Although I can empathize with Danny's situation, and Danny was a young lad who came home from school one day at the age of 13 and found that his mum had picked her new partner over him and abandoned him. And he came home to an empty house, and thereby his offending began. And so I can have empathy for his situation, but his case is quite a good example that shows that public protection is the priority, because although he'd had such a difficult life, although he'd come from that chaos that I speak about, he still presented a risk to others and he didn't get released. And that's because the public needed to be protected. And you have to make those hard choices. Sometimes in life, in doing this job, I have to make choices knowing that people are going to die in prison. And I've had to make those hard decisions sometimes. I did that, and there's a good case of a man who's got a terminal illness and he's going to die, and I have to decide whether or not he can die in the community or die, or has to die in prison. And when you look at the difficulties in terms of his risky behaviour, it was likely that he was going to commit another offence if I let him out. And so
he was a child sex offender.
He was, yeah. He and his offending was driven, again, we talk about addiction a lot. His offending was driven through alcohol. And within hours of release in the past, he ends up abusing children because he gets drunk, and that's his go-to reaction as to what he does. And so I couldn't be satisfied, even though he was terminally ill, that the first thing he wouldn't do when he got out of prison would be to drink beer and go off and offend again. And so I didn't release him, and he died soon afterwards.
And sometimes you're talking about people who are very elderly, very frail, and might not be sort of out and about in the world, but nevertheless, they could pose a risk to people, you know, maybe grandchildren visiting their grandparents in an aged care facility. People might even be curious about the old person in the shopping centre. There are still risks, and you have to be mindful of those.
Absolutely. I mean, the eldest prisoner who was on a life sentence that I refused to release because I thought he was still a risk was 92, and he was still being accused of sexual offending in prison against vulnerable prisoners. When people have health concerns, sometimes that can aggravate risk, because if people need to be in particular care facilities, then what are the risks to other patients or visitors? Or if children are coming with families to visit other people in a particular care home, you can't necessarily have somebody who's committed offences in there as well. And how will you manage that risk? And we look in extensive detail, and we have reasonable powers to be able to say what can and can't happen to make sure that the public's safe. So typically on things like that, I'm looking at what CCTV is there, what staff monitoring is there, will people be supervised, will they ever be allowed to be alone? And you're looking at all of that external risk management to make sure that really the public are going to be safe. And in some cases, as hard as it may be, if you have some idea that people deserve a chance of rehabilitation, in some cases life does mean life, and in some cases I refuse release and that leads people to die in prison.
Rob, if somebody never admits their guilt to a crime and they never kind of engage in prison programs to work on their behaviour and their way of approaching the world, does that mean that they shouldn't ever be released, or they shouldn't get early release?
People ask me that point of, well, if you don't admit to what you've done, how can you possibly ever be allowed out of prison? And when we're looking again, I'm looking at the cases that can only get released by the parole board. 90% of people are released automatically. And so lots of those will never admit to offending. And it doesn't particularly matter for them because they know that they're getting out. They've got an automatic release date. And the parole board sits as a court. That's how it operates in the UK. And the higher courts, so we've got the High Court and the Supreme Court, they shape how the parole board as a lower court should operate. And one thing those higher courts have said is that denial of offending isn't a barrier to be released. And there's a fair point in that, because actually sometimes denial can be a protective factor. It can stop people offending again because of the shame and the embarrassment and the humiliation of having been found out to have committed offences. I see it a lot with people who've committed sexual offences where they will deny the offences because they don't want to let their family down. I remember a guy who, and it's happened more than once with prisoners that I've met, but I remember a particular guy who throughout all of his sentence, he denied committing the offences, the sexual offences that he'd committed. That was because his mum truly believed that he was innocent, even though he was guilty, and it was obvious that he was guilty. But she believed in his innocence, and he didn't want to let her down. And when she died, he admitted everything. For him, at that point, it had been a protective factor for him to keep his family together with him and on side and that support there. And sometimes you see people where they don't want to accept that narrative of their life, and that is a protective factor to stop them going out and doing it again. But fundamentally, regardless of whether somebody admits their guilt or denies committing the offences that they've been convicted of, I will always assess people's risk on the basis that they did what the court said they did. So I'm assessing their risk on the basis that they committed those offences and they are guilty.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National, available anytime via ABC Listen. I'm Damien Carrick and I'm speaking with Rob McKeon. He's the author of a book titled Parole, which is based on his experiences as a member of the Parole Board of England and Wales. Not admitting to a crime is one thing, but you often find people who would say, yes, I did the crime, but that's not me anymore. So essentially not taking responsibility. Tell me about a very chilling exchange you had with a murderer that you call Simon.
So Simon was a psychopath. Simon, because he had these particular psychopathic traits of this grandiose sense of self-worth and believing him to be better, himself to be better than others, he'd come into that hearing on the belief that he was ready to be released. Everybody should agree with him. And it became apparent after giving his evidence for some time that we all had a completely different view of him, because he'd never done anything to address his offending. He'd strangled some guy in his sleep and had never looked at it, never really looked at why he did it, admitted that he'd done it, but had offered no explanation for it. And there was a chilling point when I'd asked him about the victim and whether he saw the victim's eyes as he killed him. And he got quite excited at that point and couldn't resist that question. And that's when he came out and said, I quite like strangling people. And sometimes people don't change. And Simon was one of those, I think, and would be likely to die in prison because he didn't perceive that anything he'd done was wrong. He thought he was better than other people. In fact, he was quite derogatory about other prisoners, saying that they were criminals and he wasn't, and didn't recognise the fact that he was responsible for taking a man's life, and by his own admission, had quite enjoyed it.
I think his perspective was he'd made a mistake, but one he wouldn't repeat. So no problem here, nothing to see, let him out.
Well, he took no responsibility. It was, he did something, he quite liked it. He has quite fond memories, I think, of taking that man's life. But in his view, it wasn't something that was ever going to happen again. He said, mistakes happen, but you don't have to repeat those mistakes, which was probably right in terms of what he was trying to say. But the reality for him was that all of his risk factors, all of the things that led him to come into prison in the first place were very much there and not changed. And what I'm looking for when I'm assessing people who've done some awful things, and I have to read awful accounts of violence and sexual violence, but I have to look at people's past and look at what led them to that kind of behavior, what that behavior was, the reasons for it, what's happened then on their prison journey, because people can be in prison for decades sometimes. What person have they become, and what are they likely to be like in the future? I'm trying to predict the future when I'm deciding whether people can be released. And you have to remember that some people do change, and some people can change, and some people can be different, and they're the people that you can release. But you also have to not feel sorry for people and remember that some people don't change and some people will never be safe to be released. And that's why my job is to protect the public, and people like Simon wouldn't be released.
Another form of lack of self-insight is to blame the victim for the crime. In your book, you talk about gender-based crimes and that dreadful phenomenon. Can you tell me about Curtis?
Who killed his girlfriend at the time because she'd finally taken the brave step to walk away from him. She'd been in abusive relationships in the past, and she ended up meeting Curtis. I think they met online, and they developed a quite quick relationship where they ended up living together. And he'd been abusive to her. He'd been abusive to past partners. In fact, he'd got a gambling addiction and had caused one partner in the past to lose her home because of his behaviour. But it was never his fault. It was always somebody else's fault. And he couldn't take the fact that Linda had finally plucked up the courage to leave him, and she was now living elsewhere, and he bombarded her with message after message after message after message, sometimes telling her how much he missed her and wanted a second chance and loved her, and other times just being totally abusive. And one night she agreed to meet him to say, all right, well, we can have a conversation. But she was adamant that she wasn't going to take him back. And he went round to her home, and he was adamant and certain that she would take him back. And she was adamant that she wasn't going to. And Curtis took a kitchen knife with him. And when she said no, he stabbed her and killed her. And it was always her fault, in his account, because she taunted him. She was abusive to him, despite the fact that when he stabbed her, the first thing he did was open her handbag, take her money from her purse and use it to go and gamble. So his priority was always himself. And I met Curtis years and years and years later through his life sentence. And really, his risk hadn't changed very much, because what Curtis had done was to have created a narrative that he was comfortable with. And unfortunately, those working with him in the prison had kind of accepted that narrative, that there were elements of Linda's behaviour that led him to behave in the way that he did. And you see that. You see domestic violence features in so many cases. There's another guy I talk about later on in the book who, he gets released on licence, he's automatically released, and he has an exclusion zone to keep him away from his wife. And the first thing he does is drive through it, parks outside the house and walks in through the front door. And she's not strong enough to say no, and so she takes him back. And he gets recalled to prison, and he gets her to write a letter to the parole review to say that she wants to be with him. And I don't release him because I'm pretty sure that he was going to kill her one day. And so I refused his release because he'd got absolutely no insight at all. And his view was he was married to her. He had the right to be with her. And it didn't really matter what I thought his risk was. He was going back to her, so I made sure he didn't.
And with Curtis, there are some chilling quotes you give. Quote, we argued and she pushed me over the edge. I lost my temper. I don't know what came over me. End of quote. He's blaming her, essentially. And you decided in his case, look, he's not even able to go to an open prison, because from there he could potentially commence a new relationship, and he is dangerous. So he was, at least for the foreseeable future, going to stay in jail. Have you ever made the wrong call? Have you released an offender into the community, and have they gone on to commit more serious violent crimes?
Well, you can imagine the risk, the stakes of this are high, because if you make the wrong decision, people can be seriously hurt or even killed. Now, actually, we release, as a parole board, we release about 4,500 people a year. It's about a 1 in 4 success rate in terms of people coming to see whether they can be released and actually getting released. So 3/4 don't get released, 1 in 4 do. Out of that 1 in 4, half of 1% of those that we release will go on and commit a serious further offence. And your question was about me. I've considered 5,000 prisoners, so I've probably released in the last 12 years about 1,250 people. I've had 3 people in that time have been accused of committing serious further offences. Only one has ever been convicted. So 1 out of 1,250. But you know what was really important was looking behind that and finding out what that person did and why it happened and whether you could have predicted it. And when you looked at it all, you couldn't have predicted what he'd done. But you still learn from it, and you learn other things that you want to look at to make sure that every case is a learning experience and you get something from it. So we take them all seriously, but actually the reoffending rate is really, really low, particularly when you look at 90% of the prisoners who are released automatically. A third of those will go on and reoffend.
If you do make the wrong decision, people could die. Does that possibility keep you up at night?
It's an interesting question, because I don't think this job is for everybody, because the stakes really are high. You've got to be really sure that you're making the right decision. And sometimes I make these decisions on my own. And parole board panels sit in 1, 2, or 3. So sometimes I sit alone. It's different in some of the Australian states of parole, where I think you have to have 3 or 4 members on particular panels that consider cases. But some of those cases I have to decide on my own. And so sometimes you'll sleep on it and you'll then make the decision. What it does do, rather than keeping me up at night, is to focus my mind on making sure that I do look at all of the evidence. So when I look at somebody's case, if I'm looking at somebody who's been in prison for an offence of murder, for example. I'm pretty much looking at them from the day they were born to the age that they are when they come in front of me, and I will know everything of their life. I will know so much about them from the point that they were born, what their childhood was like, to what their early adolescence was like, to what they were like in an adult, to what they've been like in prison, to what they are been like in the 2 days before the hearing when they come to see me. And prisoners are often quite surprised that I know so much about them. And that's often because they don't read the paperwork. They don't read the hundreds of pages of evidence that I get to see and that they get to see as well, which tells me all about their life. So I try to make sure and be absolutely certain that I haven't missed anything. That's what stops me having sleepless nights and helps me to make sure that I've made the right decision, because I'm making a decision based on the facts in front of me. And what you can never do is make decisions based on gut feelings. Don't look at somebody and think, oh, well, they look quite nice, or they seem quite pleasant. Because actually, quite often, it's the nicer ones that are the higher risk. So you're really, really sure that you've got the facts, that you're following the evidence, and that you're making a decision based on those facts.
I suppose we should end on a positive note. And can you tell me about somebody who people would perhaps think could not have been rehabilitated, could not have gone on to live a good life, but somebody who you know has done that, somebody you did give parole to?
There was a guy called Ben who was serving an indeterminate sentence. He'd come into prison very young. He'd come in because his offending was all driven by drug addiction, and he'd been in prison, he'd been released, he'd been recalled because he'd used drugs, and his risk really didn't really seem to be decreasing in any way. But he was a young lad. He was still in his 20s at that point. And he turned up to his first parole hearing, in fact, with me. And it was so obvious he was under the influence of drugs when he came into the room. He denied it, of course, as he would do. And for me, there was a choice at that point to either say, do you know what? If you can't even turn up sober to a parole hearing, then we might as well just say no and we'll conclude it and you can have another couple of years to sort yourself out and we'll see you then. And as he headed out of the hearing room, his trousers fell down. He was so disorganized. And I decided to give him a chance. And so we adjourned his hearing and a few things happened where I set very clear directions of, you need to address your drug use, you need to turn up sober, you need to evidence negative drug test results, and you need to start working with people in the prison to bring change about your life. The next time I saw him, he was completely different. And he'd really made an effort to bring about change. And eventually, to cut a long story short, I directed his release. And by chance, happened to find out how he'd got on, because a lot of the time you don't find out about these people once you've released them, because it's only if it goes wrong that you tend to hear. And I came across his probation officer in another hearing, and so I happened to ask about how he was doing. And he'd made a real success of his life. He'd really turned things around. He'd got himself onto a mechanics course and he was trying to build a decent future for himself. And importantly, he'd stayed away from those negative peers and the people who'd involved him in past offending and was really trying to make a difference. So you do see change. It's not all doom and gloom, that people can make a difference, but you've got to see those ones who want to make a difference and be able to work out who they are. And that's my job.
Rob McKeon, a member of the Parole Board of England and Wales since 2012, who over that time has helped decide the fate of thousands of prisoners. He's the author of a book titled Parole, which explores the dilemmas that he encounters in his role. Rob McKeon, thanks so much for speaking to the Law Report.
And thank you very much for having me along. I love Australia. It's a country I've been to many times, and I'm looking forward to coming back soon.
That's the Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and also to audio producer Kerry Dell. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more Law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.